Kia ora everyone and welcome back to another episode of the One Up Project podcast. It is March and it is time to talk about Magic Mind. I've been collaborating with them this month and using the Magic Mind shot goodness. I've just been a little bit all over the show, traveling, etc. I can't really do caffeine in those times because it spikes my heart rate and then I can't focus and I'm getting like overexcited, but not in the way that actually allows me to get anything done, in a way that I feel like I can't get into any deep work. And so it's really important that when I'm traveling, I do a couple of things to make sure that I can still be at my creative best. So that's why it's really important to me to have a base and to have tools I can rely on, like Magic Mind. Magic Mind are these really cute little shots that have just improved my mornings so much. It replaces coffee. The caffeine is matcha caffeine, which takes longer to release and helps reduce stress. Pretty much this whole product is like built around being able to reduce stress and anxiety, which I really appreciate because sometimes it's hard to find the best of both worlds. And two things are very much true with this product, in the sense that it can help you have that energy and clarity without making you feel like you are bouncing off the walls, which is me. I'm very sensitive to typical caffeine. It gives me more mental energy and focus, and I've just been loving it. I've been testing it out for over a month now, and I'm really excited that I get to work with Magic Mind on the podcast. I would highly recommend you guys try it. If you are interested, you can use my code 1UP20, and that'll get you 20% off your first one-time purchase. But it will also get you up to 56% off your first subscription. And if you're already a subscriber, you can still use it and you'll save on your next subscription payment as well. So I would go and check it out. So you can go to magicmind.com/1up to check it out and use the code 1UP20. Let's get into the episode.
I think that's such a powerful part of being an Indigenous person, is that there's so much healing in showing up in our cultural where and demonstrating our cultural practices as well. Like, mm-hmm. it's time for us to almost make our ancestors proud.
Welcome to the One Up Project.
Money is fuel that allows you to do things. It doesn't need to be taboo.
What you don't want to do is wake up at 65 realizing you did something you hated and have regret.
Go and find people who will give you advice for nothing.
This is a space for personal growth and money chat with new perspectives every Monday.
This bit of content, listening to this, is going to be a small little breadcrumb of something that makes them think a little bit differently.
For all the things we were never taught but should have been.
At the end of the day, the most important person is yourself, and if you're not happy with your own choices, then you're never going to be happy.
Today on the podcast, I have the incredible, and I mean that in every sense of the word, an unbelievably amazing person, Tai Whirani Watene. Tai is one of those gifts to this earth who exude warmth and light. I think I've used the word warm every time I've described her because it is just the perfect word. Talking to her feels like you're getting a hug, and it feels like you're getting validation and empathy and understanding. She's just amazing in every way. I'm so beyond happy that we get to have her on this podcast today. She so effortlessly and naturally opened up to us about her personal healthcare challenges, her neurosurgery, how this completely transformed her life, leading to volunteering with youth groups and representing Indigenous voices at the United Nations Global Goals Week in the United States. She's also just received the Global Citizen Youth Leader Award, a prize awarded to young innovators working to address the issues perpetuating extreme poverty. She is dedicated to empowering Māori and Pacifica rangatahi, addressing institutional disparities and advocating for co-governance. No doubt she has a million and one accolades yet to be awarded to her in her lifetime, because besides this, she also has her regular mahi that she goes to and does every single day as well. So big passion around advocating for equality, the environment, disability, queer and Indigenous rights. She aims to influence global decision making and create a more sustainable model for future generations through raising Indigenous voices. This is something we spoke a lot about in today's episode. discussing South Pacific Indigenous representation in the international discourse on sustainable development. We also spoke about Tai's role as a big sister, her relationship with her mum being raised by a single mum growing up, and just her active involvement in creating change for future generations of people. I, like so many others, are so immensely proud of the person she is. A woman to be watched and supported and encouraged. Please let me know what you think of this conversation. I'll link Tai and anything else we talk about below. I can't wait to hear your thoughts. And here is Tai. Tai, it is a pleasure to have you here. I can't stop smiling because I love you. You're just so warm and inviting. Your energy is one of my favorites. I appreciate you so much. I would love to hear so much more about your mahi and your heart work. But welcome to the One Up Project podcast. How are you?
Thank you. I'm really well, thanks. And you know what? I actually was thinking about this yesterday, how much of a full circle moment this is, because one of the things that brought me and my partner together was actually this podcast. And I think I told you. I told you this at Y25 when we sat next to each other when I was fangirling and I was like, oh my gosh. And I was like hitting my partner, I was like, that's her. That's the One Up Project. this is such a bucket list moment for me. So thanks so much for having me. I've honestly been such a big fan of your mahi for ages.
Yes, that's right. I remember, and I just so appreciate that. Like, it means obviously heaps, and unbelievable that someone as incredible as you would, so believable that someone as incredible as you would be interested, because only the most amazing people listen to this podcast. But thank you. That is so lovely. I love that so much. Your partner must have been like, oh my God, what the heck? Calm down.
No, he was fangirling as well, but he was trying to be cool about it. I'm like, don't be cool with me. I know we're going to be talking about this in the car ride home.
Not the debriefs. Yes. I love it. That's so funny. Oh my God, appreciate you both so much and love that. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Your time is obviously so completely valued. Your perspective is one that needs to be shared on so many more microphones than just the one I can offer you today. So can you please tell us a little bit more about your mahi and why your passion is so close to your heart?
Yeah, sure thing. So I guess my mahi is kind of split into two parts. So I like to say that my paid mahi is as a senior comms advisor in the public sector, but that mahi just funds the mahi that I feel like I'm really called to do, which is in the sustainable development space. So something that I've been really passionate about over the last couple of years has been really elevating the voices of our Indigenous communities in the South Pacific in the global discourse when it comes to sustainable development. So it's been such a journey for the last couple of years, and I think a lot of this kind of stemmed from my neurosurgery that I had back in 2020, right before the COVID lockdown happened. And that was a huge perspective shift for me, because I realized, oh my gosh, you know, had my brain cut open, had the back of my spine cut open. Life is very precious, you know, and it was definitely like, it was definitely a wake up call for me. And then that was when I started to really invest in my volunteer work. And I did a lot of mahi with a lot of youth organizations and civics education at first, and racial justice. And then that over time has kind of transitioned into the sustainable development space. So this mahi has been really important to me, because when I started getting more involved in this space, I noticed that there weren't a lot of faces that looked like mine, and the faces, that did look like mine, it was the same faces everywhere I went. And I've managed to develop such beautiful relationships with a lot of these people who I've seen. And I think a common drive that we've all had is to make these spaces that have typically not been welcoming to Māori or Pasifika people, to be more inclusive, and what kind of barriers do we need to start breaking down in order for that better representation of our community. So, and I guess another driver for me has also been my two little sisters, Blake and Ridley. They're 7 and 6, and they are the biggest rascals on the planet, but they are such a central part to my why, and they really drive me to do what I can to try and leave behind, I don't know, some sort of impact for them, so that they can grow up in a world where they're strong Pasifika women. And I want to make sure that all the barriers that I kind of experienced growing up, where I didn't feel like I could belong anywhere. I don't want them to ever have to experience that. And so this mahi has been such a, it's been so transformative for me. And it's been definitely like a calling that I've discovered in my life. And I'm really blessed to be able to kind of work in this space, in and outside of mahi, like my paid mahi. And
Wow.
Bit of a download, sorry.
Amazing. And what an incredible role model Blake and Ridley both have as well. I would love to have had a big sister like you in my life growing up, and also a very unique journey that you've gone on in terms of those realizations post neurosurgery. And I'm sure you had no idea like the transformation you're about to go through, not only having that surgery and of course the physical and emotional impacts that come as a result of that, but then also within your life and everything you learnt beyond that. So what were kind of the first steps you began to take, or when did the realization start happening post that neurosurgery that made you decide that you wanted to take more of an active position in contributing to your communities and society?
Prior to my neurosurgery, and also prior to being diagnosed with a brain condition, I had always really struggled at uni. But throughout my whole life, I was raised by a single mother. She really pushed me to do well in school and to get into a well-paying career so that I can help support my family. That has been something that has really been ingrained in me from a young age. But when I started going to university, I was really struggling with the, I guess, the intensity of going to tutorials, and I struggled a lot with my anxiety and depression. And there were lots of external factors that were kind of that I feel like limited me from being the best that I could be at uni. But when I had been diagnosed with my brain condition, my doctor said, like, the way that your condition's kind of set up, it's pressing on the nerves that actually trigger your anxiety and trigger your, you know, those feelings of depression as well. And so a lot of that started to make sense to me. That I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not losing it. It's not just a circumstantial thing, but it's actually my body just kind of failing me. And that was, that was quite probably my turning point there, when I realized, oh, I'm actually capable of doing anything. I have just got, you know, this physical limitation that is going to be fixed soon, so I better make the most of it, because the condition that I had is called Chiari malformation. It's not incredibly severe, but it is very underdiagnosed because it's an expensive kind of condition to identify. And for me, I was only able to have mine identified after years of going to doctors and saying, you know, I'm struggling with these massive migraines. I also have, you know, I'm really sensitive to situations that trigger my anxiety. I have sometimes like weird symptoms, like I can't swallow sometimes. I don't know why that is. And my doctors always narrowed it down, which is, was real humbling, but always tried to narrow it down to my weight. And I was like, not the fat shaming in the doctor's office. And so from like, I don't know, the age of 16 to 22, you know, had to kind of really advocate for myself. With the health system in New Zealand, and say, no, I've got something, and it's not what is typically classed for a lot of other Pasifika or Māori women. It's not just down to my BMI, but there's something deeper. And there was one point where I had such a severe migraine that I was like, oh my gosh, I have a blood clot in my brain. And it was just like, you know, when your thoughts just kind of fly, of and they, it was just ruminating quite a lot. And so I went to my doctor, and luckily, my employer at the time had just gone through some changes in our health insurance. So I had full healthcare through, and it was like premium and whatever. And so I was like, I'm going to eat this up. I'm going to just use as much of the perks as I can. And so then when I went to my doctor, I said, I've got this health insurance. Give me all the stuff, you know, give me all the goods. I want everything. And so they then, They pushed me through to have a CT scan. My results came back and they were like, oh, there's something a little bit further down in your spine that we need to look at. So then I had a full MRI, and then there was lots of appointments between, you know, specialists and my doctors and everything. And then that was when they narrowed it down to, this is carrier malformation. And with carrier malformation, it's the back of your brain. It's something called the amygdala, and I might not be pronouncing that right, but yeah. There's this little bean looking thing, and mine was slipping into my spinal canal. So when that happens, a lot of the spinal fluid was getting trapped in one place, which was what was, you know, triggering a lot of migraines and a lot of those nerves that were getting pressed where they shouldn't be. And so once they were able to identify that, they told me if it's more than 4 millimeters, then we can perhaps consider surgery. But mine was 11 millimeters, so it was pretty significant. Wow. And because of that, I got pushed to have an operation within 6 months. And then that led me to 2020, which is when I had my operation. And I was at home for a couple of weeks just trying to figure out, okay, well, now that this has been sorted, I guess I'd better go make the most of my life. And during that time, I had been kind of trying to get more involved at uni by joining a few clubs. And one of the clubs that I had joined, I had applied to be the coordinator for a national event called the Aotearoa Youth Declaration. And that was such a pivotal experience, seeing young people around the country, just the bright minds that we have in Aotearoa is amazing. And for me, that had really driven me to think, I want my sisters to come to this kind of space, and I want them to be vocal about what they experience living in Porirua, living as, you know, as young Pasifika women. And which, yeah, it kind of sounds like helicopter sister, mapping out my sister's life before they even had a chance.
You will do this.
But, you know, even if they decide not to, I want that to still be an option for them, and I want them to be able to know that they can join these spaces and they can feel confident that their voices are going to be valued and that they're not going to be dismissed as, you know, some angry kind of brown woman, but they'll be taken seriously. And that really started my journey into realizing, actually, you know, this is great, but what more can I do? And for me, I really struggle with imposter syndrome, and I, you know, Nina Santos did an incredible episode a few episodes ago in One Up Project about imposter syndrome and everything. And I've learned a lot from being part of the Y25 program about how I can manage that. But before joining and before meeting a lot of these incredible wahine, I had to try and figure that out on my own. So going through a lot of these, supporting a lot of incredible kaupapa and organizations, opened my eyes to, you know, what is it, like narrowing down, what is my why, what is it that I'm actually passionate about? And at the end of the day, at the end of every conversation that I had and every event that I went to, it was always about making sure that our Māori and Pasifika kids were well taken care of. And it was making sure that, okay, you see this organizing that we're doing, you know, you can do this as well one day. And if there's something in that's part of this conversation or part of this event that you're not happy with, you have the absolute capability and capacity to change that. And there should be no limitations. And, you know, there were some instances where I was in an organization that pushed back on some of the changes that we wanted to make. But, you know, I think once you started to build that relationship with the wider, I guess, leadership team, I don't know, with the right people, then and you start explaining to them, actually, this is a systemic issue, what you're kind of feeding into. And this isn't just unique to this organization. This is something that all Pasifika people and Māori people experience. Then their eyes kind of start to realize, oh, actually, yeah, maybe we aren't as inclusive as we'd like to be. That's kind of what has come from my neurosurgery. And even though it was a very scary time of my life, I am so grateful for it, and I wouldn't change anything for the world, because the opportunities that have come since then have really helped me understand my purpose on earth, and have also made my sisters proud, made my mum proud, and that's all I can really ask for in life.
100%. Your clarity around your why is so inspiring. And probably a rare gift that a lot of people aren't allowed in their lifetime as well, is that clarity. But it sounds like through your journey of having to, without a choice, having to advocate for yourself in the spaces that you entered, and asking for help and saying, no, I want everything this health insurance can offer, and, you know, being there to make sure you can take advantage of every opportunity you were offered, being going through that. And that takes a lot of strength and courage to do that. It allowed you and maybe gave you the space to be able to do that for other people as well. It's a really special outcome of what I can only imagine was an incredibly difficult time for you.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because you know, when you talk about courage, the first person that just came to my mind now was my mum. And my mum's a first generation Samoan born, and throughout her life, you know, she had encountered extreme poverty. She was widowed at a really young age, and my dad, he passed away due to suicide. And having to deal with that as a woman of colour, having to deal with that as a young woman, there was a lot of it just kind of felt like the world collapsing on you, right? But my mum has never ever made me feel like she couldn't do anything, and she has been such a strong pillar of courage for me. And so when I go into these spaces, you know, I'd be like, oh mum, you know, I've been dealing with this really difficult board member or whatever, she'd just be like, well, you know, get over it, because it could be worse. you're in a very privileged position that not a lot of people have the opportunity to be in, and so you better go and make the most of it. And for me, I'm kind of like having to change my perspective, but she's also made me feel like I can back myself. And and before, you know, before my operation, I kind of thought, no, why was me, you know, always having a pity party, like, I can't do this. But now I feel like I need to have my mindset shifted, because, like, she's so right, you know, there's not a lot of people who have access to these spaces, and who am I to, you know, not take advantage of this platform and speak for people who aren't here? Or even if, like, not speaking for others, but just bring to awareness that, hey, we're missing some people at this table right now, and I hope you know that that's not okay, and I hope you know that that should be changed. So yeah, I owe a lot of the confidence that I have to my mum, because she demonstrated that a lot throughout my lifetime, and I witnessed her through some of the hardest times of our life, and she's always carried through with such strength and such mana that, yeah, she's one of my biggest giants in my life, and so grateful for her.
It's so important for people, and that's just a theme I've noticed throughout so many of these episodes now, is that it's so important for people to have others in their life that believe in them, or tell them they can do anything, or demonstrate that they can do anything, and help them to believe that more than the reality they exist within is possible, or something different is possible. And it sounds like that was very much who your mum was and continues to be for you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's spot on.
What themes, I guess, from the lessons you've taken from your mum have been some of the more difficult ones to learn and implement in your life?
Oh gosh, I think that one of the things that we're still working through together is managing intergenerational trauma. And that's not you know, the fault of her or my grandparents that came to New Zealand, but it is the impacts of colonization and how our people have had to assimilate to Western culture. And I think that, you know, for my family at least, my family are very well educated. They're extremely smart people. They have this head screwed on really well, but there have been circumstances where they're not able to fully thrive because there are obligations to our community that sometimes supersede what I guess the Western world would deem as really important, you know. And I think that that has really set us back. And I think what is really beautiful about this generation that's coming up now is that this is being identified and that this is being addressed head on. You know, we see our Pasifika people and our Māori rangatahi leading rallies and leading marches to our decision makers to say, hang on, you know, this is how it's been in the last however many years. This needs to change, and we need to allow for all of our people to thrive, but in order to do that, we need to address what's happening in our most marginalized communities in New Zealand.
And I love that it sounds like you and your mum take on a lot of these challenges as a team, like it's you and her together facing these things. I'm sure your two younger sisters as well, as opposed to feeling like even your mum has to do it all alone. It sounds like you support her so much in that as well.
Yeah, and it's funny because we often talk about this, that my sisters are going to have an extremely different upbringing to my mum and I, or to how my mum raised me at least. And I am, you know, I wouldn't, like I said before, I wouldn't change anything for the world, but my sisters will not grow up seeing, you know, violence. They will not grow up seeing different types of abuse in the household. And I refuse for them to think that they aren't able to do well in education if they decide to pursue that. Mm. And so even though my mum is their mother, I feel like we've definitely been trying to look at how we can almost heal her parts of her childhood, heal my parts of my childhood through my sisters. And that has really brought us together, especially when I've started investing more time and energy into this mahi and in Indigenous prosperity. I want that to first be seen through my own household and in my own village, you know. And so I think for me and my mum, this is definitely something that I don't do alone. And I always carry her with me, and I carry my sisters with me in every room that I go in. But at the end of the day, yeah, there are bigger things that that are out of our control, but it's more how can we work together to address those and to overcome them together as well.
Mm. How does that feel to know that you've taken an active part in changing the way two young people grow up in this society?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, props to all parents in the world. Like, it's flipping hard.
Yeah.
Honestly, kids can be a-holes sometimes. But no, it's also been it's such an emotional journey as well, seeing my little sisters grow up. And I was living at home for right up until they started school, and everything they do just feels like a milestone, you know. Like when my sister decided to do swimming, I was like, oh my gosh, look at her swimming. She's by herself, swimming. Like, I'm so proud of her, you know. You know, I think even seeing my little sister on the playground and she's sticking up for someone else, I'm like, oh my gosh, look at her, I'm so proud. It's like such a spectrum of, like, I don't know, like such a spectrum of things for me to witness in my sister's childhoods. And
yeah,
it's such an emotional journey. Oh, even like, so my sisters do the Weetbix triathlon. When my younger sister Blake, so she was six when she did the first her first triathlon, and or duathlon, whatever, and when she crossed the finish line, I was like bawling my eyes out. And then I met her, and then she started bawling out too. And so me and Blake, and then Ridley was just in the background like crying, but because she felt left out. But all of us were just crying. And I was like, this is such a big deal for us. And so I'm like, oh god, how am I going to contain myself when they actually do something with their life? I'm going to have a breakdown. But
this is just a Weetbix triathlon. I love that. It's so good. But how special.
Yeah, and I all I want for them to know is, like, when they grow up, that they have every opportunity at their hands. You know, there's nothing that's stopping them from doing anything. And I hope that the work that I do can flow on to other communities as well. Like, I don't want to just limit that to my sisters. I want that to be felt throughout our Pasifika and Māori communities and across the Pacific Islands. And I just want to do my part in serving others. And I want others to know that, yeah, especially like coming from a community where you're always getting shut down, or you have these stigma and stereotypes always being thrown at you. Like, I just want people to understand. I just want my communities to understand, at least, or those who haven't kind of found that revelation yet, because our people are really, they're strong, they're resilient, and they're fighters as well. And I just want to make sure that all the work that I do will benefit the wider community and not just limit them to my two little sisters. So they are a big part of that.
Yeah. No, I can tell you from my perspective, at least, that you just existing as you are is serving people in so many ways every single day. I want to hear more about if and where South Pacific and Indigenous perspectives are or aren't currently being valued. in the context of sustainable development. How have you seen that, I suppose, evolve for the work you've done?
I feel like it's impossible to not hear South Pacific Indigenous voices, because we're loud. You know, if we're not loud in volume, we're loud in showing up, and we're loud in spirit. And so the question is, like, are those voices being valued? And I don't think that they are, to the extent that it's that it has the potential to be. And I feel like we see that a lot with global forums such as COP or Davos or the Global Goals Week. A lot of our Pasifika people and our Maori Indigenous communities, they are on the front lines, and they're working with other Indigenous communities to start organizing and leading rallies. And, you know, we're paying homage to the people of the land and just working together. And I think that's that kind of service and that kind of activism is so powerful, because no matter what kind of global forum is being organized or is being held around the world, you'll always have at least one Pasifika person in Māori. Sorry, I always like say Pasifika as like a generic, you know, Pacific Islands, anyone of the Te Moni Nui Akiwa. Yeah. But it's, yeah, we have such strong activists in our community that when there is an opportunity to attend these global events, there'll at least be one. There won't be the last, and then they're definitely not the first either, but there'll at least be someone there, and then that I can just feel with my heart and spirit that they're screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, to remember what's happening on this side of the world, because we're often left out, and we're not the face of a lot of these global forums either. But from my experience, when I went to the Global Goals Week in New York City, there were lots of events happening across the Global Goals Week. And what I saw from their calendar is that there weren't any options to engage with our South Pacific Indigenous communities. So that, to me, says that there's clearly not a lot of value from that decision-making table to include our voices. But instead, where was everyone? They were on the streets, and they were leading chants, and they were working with the beautiful Indigenous communities from around the world to fight for climate action. And we saw the Pacific Climate Warriors there, Brown of Frawn was there, the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty organizers were there as well. And that for me was such a beautiful moment, because I was walking down the street one day and I saw someone wearing a traditional Samoan attire, and I remember staring at him and I was like, oh my god, can he recognize me? Because I had my phone number, and I'm like, please recognize me. Please, no, but, you know, it's me, it's a cousin. And then we ended up like crossing from the like opposite ends of the street to say hello to each other, and I was like, oh, are you from Samoa? I'm from New Zealand. And then we connected immediately, and I was like, what are you doing here? And he said that he was here to contribute to the to the call to action for the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. And we immediately started like connecting and talking about, like, far out, like, it's so nice to see another Pasifika here, and it's crazy to see the work that we're doing in different spaces, but, you know, it's all to one cause, which is to help create a more sustainable world. So that was such an incredible moment for me. And yeah, I think what was really beautiful is that it just demonstrates that we have people everywhere, and we have people advocating for all sorts of issues and concerns, and it's just having access to those kind of platforms, and whether or not they'll allow us to have a seat at the table, which often isn't in our hands. So, you know, if we're not being let at the table, then I guess we'll just go make our own. And there's such a beautiful sense of collectivism in that moment, because one thing that I've definitely noticed it is that with a lot of Indigenous communities, there's no issue with having too many cooks in the kitchen, and there's no ego, there's no you know, arrogance or hierarchy. There's just this drive and this burning desire to create a sustainable world together, and Indigenous communities are facing the brunt of not meeting these goals in when it comes to climate action, when it comes to well-being, or even economic prosperity as well. But we have to work together, and we're often trying to really advocate for ourselves at the tables of these decision makers, who, honestly, sometimes I feel like they don't even bat an eye. But I think the tides are turning, and people are starting to realize, oh, look at these very loud people waving their flags with their drums, singing, you know, with their beautiful cultural attire. Like, you cannot ignore us. Mm. And I think that's such a powerful part of being an Indigenous person, is that there is so much of there's so much healing in showing up in our cultural wear and demonstrating our cultural practices as well. Like, mm-hmm. it's time for us to almost make our ancestors proud and really show up in these spaces, because, you know, there was never a chance before, or there probably was a lot of difficulty in getting to these tables before, but a lot of those glass ceilings being shattered and will continue to be shattered. And I say that with conviction, because I'm like, no, this is not.
Absolutely. Yeah. You say it so beautifully. And that collective wisdom and collaboration is absolutely something that Indigenous communities have down. There seem to be so many obstacles hindering effective Indigenous representation in sustainable development conversations. So how do you view solutions to this when you're trying to change something, I suppose, from the inside out, with a lot of like weight of those barriers against you? How do you view what progress and a solution kind of looks like?
One of the things that I feel like is really close to my heart when it comes to sustainable development is that Indigenous ancestral knowledge is the key. And so for me, seeing that in action, and, you know, it can be as small as even seeing people wearing, like as I said before, wearing cultural attire, that for me shows that we're showing our resistance and we're showing our strength by bringing our ancestors with us. And being able to see initiatives that are really centered on ancestral knowledge, which you see a lot in North American and South American and sustainable initiatives, is weaving that knowledge together. For me, that is progress, because that's what helped our planet thrive for years before capitalism kind of plagued our lands. And and I think another thing is that I see as success, seeing our Indigenous people on those forums to be in the organizing or consulting committee, being the face of these, for me is huge progress, because it means that our people are being considered and are being valued right up to the right up to the very end. I think that it's important for our Indigenous people to be at a lot of these decision-making tables, because there's just been such an exclusive elitism around when it comes to funding initiatives or just even running these global events and global forums, like making sure that no voice is left behind, because that way our representation can really make a difference, and we see things that perhaps other Western communities or Western decision makers don't often see. And that's because of our collectivism, and it's because of our shared struggle that we faced all over the world.
Completely. What are some of those key disparities and challenges faced by Indigenous communities that aren't maybe spoken about at these forums and events as a result of not having that representation?
So it starts off with systemic issues, and I think that the biggest systemic issue that Indigenous people face is the impacts of colonization. And through colonization, that's definitely where a lot of individualism has come in and really torn apart our communities, our lifestyles, and our way of living. It's so centered to just the one, and for us it's so unnatural. For a lot of Pasifika and a lot of other Indigenous communities, it's just not It's not just a regular way of life. You know, you don't just think about yourself. You're constantly thinking about your village. You constantly think about your family. This has been one of the biggest challenges that we're having to overcome, because we're having to assimilate to this idea that it's always about the one. It's always about the one. Just helping the one, but we want to help the community. Sorry, Sarah.
No. That makes total sense. Like, something I often think about, and I completely agree with you on everything you've just said, is how that typically Western perspective of focusing on yourself and that individualism, as you say, only works to hinder people and communities in the long term anyway. And I think often a lot of people have it backwards in so many conversations in the Western world. When we talk about progress or getting ahead, it's always spoken about in the context of the one, and never as a community. And it seems like if more people focused more on sharing that prosperity with the people around them, having a community focus, actually people would feel a lot more fulfilled in their lives anyway, and would probably thrive in so much easier. It's so hard for so many people to imagine when it's been ingrained in them for so long as well. And so I think that Indigenous perspective is one that absolutely needs to be heard so much more, and needs to be spoken about in a way that it's not just about including a different perspective. What it's about is actually sharing a potentially more effective way of life that can help and provide solutions to so many more people.
And, you know, I think that one of the biggest things that one of the biggest things that people forget is that colonization has actually led to a lot of the disparities that have triggered, you know, needing to have the sustainable development goals developed in the first place. And a lot of the goals that are involved is around zero hunger, quality education, gender equality, even like, you know, clean energy and everything. And those 17 goals, you can definitely see that there is space for Indigenous knowledge to really be taken into consideration as something that has worked for so many other communities around the world before colonization. And it's something that I don't think is currently being taken seriously. And that's why I would love to see more involvement with Indigenous communities from a global scale, which we can hopefully aspire towards with, pushing for more representation at the UN, or more representation in, nationally, and, empowering our young Indigenous leaders to reach those seats as decision makers for countries as well.
It almost just feels like a big joke when you think about the fact that so many of these global goals were built by or within a system that caused it, and people were then also trying to find solutions to goals within the same system that caused the problems to begin with.
Absolutely. And I think it is no surprise to a lot of people who have experienced, you know, systemic barriers or institutional barriers, but it just feels like, here's another thing to add to your plate. Not only are you struggling locally or regionally or nationally, but internationally as well now. So it definitely feels like, as you said, you kind of just need to laugh a little bit, because it's like, once again, we have to try and solve more problems that was instigated by very rich, powerful people who we never would have considered the impacts of their actions on a long-term scale. So it was very now, very centered to now, very centered to one.
How do you manage the emotional impacts of what seems like can be such a frustrating process?
It can be quite overwhelming sometimes. And I think that's why it's so important that if you're going to be working, or if you're going to be investing any of your time into any form of activism, you need to be with a community. You cannot do it by yourself. When I was doing a lot of research and trying to, prepare myself for some board meetings and some events that I was attending, I just felt a huge sense of almost like lack of control and not being able to solve everything at once. But what has really helped me, and something that I've definitely learned from Latavia, has been to, lean on the giants around you, lean on people who are who are fighting the same fight as you. I think that's why it's so beautiful to be part of a wider community that is passionate about this, because it's not just the struggle that I'm experiencing on my own. It's not emotions that I am facing by myself. This is something that others are facing too, but sharing that together has made it a lot easier to kind of think of practical steps ahead. You know, I can't save the world, but one step at a time. One step at a time, what can I do to do my part in creating impact? But it is overwhelming, and I think we definitely see it a lot with people who are protesting and advocating for a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. It's so jarring to think that, you know, I can't do anything on my own, but as a collective, we can do something, and as a collective, we can aspire towards change in that way as well. So yeah, when I think of the emotions I felt, I'm like, man, I felt real gutted at times, but I could be so much worse. I feel like there's a responsibility that if you have the privilege to be active in any kind of space, then do it.
I think the privilege I have is a tool that I can use to help other people. And that's how I choose to view that journey I go on personally, I suppose. But it sounds like with you, a lot of that managing the emotional repercussions that come with your mahi actually comes back to a very Indigenous perspective of making sure that you can look to your community and be there with or lean on those people around you to share those experiences and find strength in other people's perspective as well. Do you want to talk about your project that you're working on?
Yes. So this has been a passion project that's just kind of been on my heart for a long time. And I started to unpack it a little bit when I had actually reached out to the Y25 for some input on, you know, what are some gaps that I'm experiencing? What are some gaps that you see in this passion project of mine? And please provide some feedback. And since the announcement of going to Global Citizen in a few weeks, it has, I guess, officially been announced that I'm looking to establish a community for Indigenous changemakers in the South Pacific, and that's called Whakata 2030. So essentially what that looks like is, at first it'll start off as a community to work together and to share initiatives that are happening. But what I would love to see for this this kaupapa to grow into is, you know, I'd love to see changemakers attend these global forums, and I would love to provide a pathway for our bright minds in the South Pacific to share our knowledge and share our ancestors' approach to a sustainable lifestyle for the world in a safe way, so that we're not exploited, but it's also providing a pathway for other nations who are perhaps experiencing, you know, impacts of climate change and well-being or even gender equality, for them to have these tools to consider in their initiatives as well. So yeah, Whakata 2030 has definitely been something that has been kind of brewing in my heart and just hasn't really had any place to go. But I'm really excited to invest more into it and to see that really grow. I'm not sure what that will look like in the next couple of months, but it's definitely going to be an exciting journey, and I'm really grateful for the mātauranga of a lot of giants who are around me and who have shared a lot of wisdom in this space too.
I am very excited for this, and also I'm excited that you're leading this, because I can't think of any better person to begin something like that. And if people are wanting to get involved or are curious about what you're doing, is there anywhere they can go right now, or should they just watch this space?
Watch this space. Hoping to establish a few social media channels in the next couple of weeks. Yeah, from then I guess more information will be shared on those platforms so that we can get lots more people involved, because this is definitely a space that has a lot of interest from a lot of friends who I've spoken to about this, and who aspire to go to things like COP, things like Davos, or the Global Goals Week. And so yeah, we're just having baby steps, small steps first, and then yeah, can't wait to see it flourish in the future.
Absolutely, and flourish it will. Ty, thank you so much for being here today. You mentioned shattering glass ceilings earlier, and you absolutely are doing that in so many spaces. But not only are you doing it, you're encouraging, supporting, and inspiring so many people I know to do the exact same. And you do it in a way that is so warm and nurturing, but obviously exudes this resilience that is so unique as well. I'm really inspired by you. I just appreciate who you are so much. Every time I talk to you, I feel refreshed, energized, and ready to go and contribute to something else, something to help make this world a better place. And so I hope you know that you're doing that not only for me, but so many other people. And today we get to share that with everyone who's listening. So it is more than a privilege and honor, a pleasure for you to be on this podcast. And thank you again.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sarah. It's been such a blast chatting with you. And I'm so grateful for all the mahi that you're doing as well. You're such a beautiful light in my life, honestly. Thank you so much for this. And yeah, really excited to see what comes up next as well.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The One Up Project. If you want to find more stuff just like this, check out our other apps or follow us at The One Up Project on Instagram or TikTok. See you there.